Welcome to Betrayal Recovery Radio, the official podcast of APSATS, the Association of Partners of Sex Addict Trauma Specialists, hosted by Dr. Jake Porter. APSATS is a nonprofit organization providing professional training and compassionate support to partners affected by problematic sexual behavior and betrayal trauma. In each episode, Dr. Jake guides a conversation of enlightening insights and practical tools to empower those affected by sex addiction and betrayal trauma to use their voices and live their values. The mission of Betrayal Recovery Radio is to offer hope to those in need of healing and growth to those moving through grief. And now, here's your host, Dr. Jake Porter.
Welcome to another episode of Betrayal Recovery Radio, the official podcast of the Association of Partners of Sex Addicts Trauma Specialists. I'm your host, Dr. Jake Porter, and I have a special treat for you this week. So every year now, for the last few years, I have been hosting a free online summit for couples called the Choose Connection Summit, specifically designed for couples who are seeking to heal and recover from the effects of sex addiction and or betrayal trauma. This year's summit is scheduled for March 19th through the 25th. So it's coming up here in just a couple weeks. And I want to offer you all a free pass to the summit. If you'll go to ChooseConnectionSummit.com, you can get your free pass. There you'll be able to have access to all the talks as they are being launched, and also free access to each of them for 24 hours after its scheduled time for airing. And as a way of letting you know some of the amazing content that you'll get from that summit, this week's episode, I'm actually going to give you a sneak peek to one of the sessions. This is a session in which my teammate, my friend, my colleague, Dr. Wendell Gill, is going to be interviewing another one of my teammates and colleagues here at Daring Ventures, Laura Childers, as they talk about connection, looking at brain-based realities around empathy, relationships, addiction, and trauma. It's a really amazing conversation. Laura and Wendell are both people who are so brilliant, so good at what they do, and so insightful. Wendell has a doctorate in education and works particularly often with addicts and with couples. And his focus is on emotional intelligence, emotional labor, building capacity for empathy. These are the big sorts of things his research has been focused on through his doctoral work and where much of his own work has been. And then Laura is an expert on healing brains using brain-based treatment, neurofeedback, neurotherapy. She is our director of clinical neurotherapy here at Daring Ventures. And she really uses cutting-edge technology to restore balance to minds where there's been injury through addiction, injury through trauma. She treats dysregulations in the brain and has just been having amazing results here with this this phenomenal method of treatment that is groundbreaking in many, many ways. And so this is just one of the sessions that is going to air during the summit. And I was so impressed when I heard it. I thought it was so informative in telling us what's going on in the brain around trauma and around addiction and giving even a sense of hope, you know, that thing that we can heal from that, that I wanted to share that with you, give you a taste of what you could get with that free ticket to the summit. Again, that's ChooseConnectionSummit.com. I do also want to mention a few other things before we jump in to Wendell's interview with Laura. That are coming up that APSATS is sponsoring that are also going to be really, really great. So March 24th through the 26th, Dan Drake and Janice Cottle will be offering Restoring Truth Disclosure Guide training. So professionals who are in this field who want to sharpen your own skills at preparing people and facilitating the formal therapeutic disclosure process. That's going to be an outstanding training. Dan and Janice both are part of the summit as well. But this particular training will be for clinicians and coaches to sharpen their own skill in that work. Next month, April 13th through 14th, Jessica Edens will be offering a workshop called Betrayed Families, Support for Children and Families. So often, so much attention goes to the person with the addiction, the person who did the betraying, that maybe we need help learning how to better support those who are feeling some of the consequences around that, particularly children and families. That'll be another powerful and wonderful workshop. And then I also want to go ahead and let you know, more recently announced on May 5th, Dan Drake will be doing a workshop called Boundaries for the Sex Addict, How to Delicately Manage Safety for Both Partner and Addict. All of these events, you can find out more at appsats.org. All the links I've mentioned for the summit, for appsats, and to learn more about Laura and Wendell, they'll all be in the notes for this episode. So let's get right to it. Sit back. I know you're going to enjoy and learn a lot from this interview between my friends, Wendell Gill and Laura Childers.
Hello, everyone. It's good to have you with us today for our 2023 summit, and the theme of which is reaching new heights. And I'm delighted today to have Laura. Is it Childers or Childers? How is it?
Childers.
Childers. That's what I thought. Just wanted to make sure. So Laura Childers is with us today, and Laura's work is focused on healing brains. She does neurofeedback and also neuromodulation, which is brain-based assessment, treatment. And this work, Laura, you've inspired hope through giving a clear, objective understanding about life struggles and how they relate to what's going on in our brain. And this happens by restoring balance of mind and creating awareness of wisdom. And through that, you're helping clients to fulfill their life's passions and purpose. So you use a state-of-the-art equipment, right, to assess and also to treat these dysregulations within the brain. And your work deals with trauma, addiction, ADHD, learning difficulties, depression, anxiety, many other diagnoses. I'm just grateful to be here to interview you today, Laura. Welcome.
Thank you, Wendell. I'm excited to be here today.
So our interview is going to be about brain-based healing, how empathy perhaps develops, and authentic living in light of what we know and come to learn is going on in our brains. So just to start off, Laura, here's a question that just occurs to me. What was it that got you involved in this work in your own story, perhaps?
Yes. Yeah, absolutely. It's, you know, been quite a journey, honestly, to get to this place. Sometimes life culminates into all of the experiences into a place where you can be there to heal others, which is an awesome thing, which is a wonderful thing. And so so I started this journey back in I guess 2014 is when I first started this journey into the brain-based healing. And I actually had a nephew who was struggling, and I had been learning about neurofeedback and brain-based treatment. And so I talked to his mom about it. And so she chose a place to go to and said, "Hey, do you want to come since you suggested this?" And I said, "Great, I'd love to." And so I went to the appointment. I sat in on the sessions with my nephew and really learned a lot. And he's made, you know, really good changes. And so that inspired me. So I thought, you know what? I want to try this. Yeah. So I tried it, and I felt like it was really making changes, you know, in places where, because I'd done a lot of my own therapy. And so it was making changes in places where I felt like that I hadn't been able to move forward therapeutically in some senses. And that really inspired me. And so, yeah.
That's really neat. And often, as many people know, what gets us into this work is something personal experience. So that's inspiring. So you are also a licensed professional counselor, right? So you hold that licensing also, and which certainly serves as a basis for your knowledge of how therapy works.
Yeah, actually, that's what I was told, in doing my own treatment, is that you can do this also. You have a license, you can diagnose, and so you can do this treatment in your field of study.
Good. Well, and we're grateful that you're a part of the Daring Ventures team. And so that's also something I want everybody to know that, as colleagues, we get to work together and get to help clients sort of from complementary approaches. So that'll probably come up in our interview probably. So most everybody will say we're social creatures. We hear that all the time. We were designed, created, or evolved, whatever, somebody might want to believe about any of that. But the idea right now is that we're social creatures and that our brains are wired to be so social. How do we know that? How do we know that our brains are wired to be social?
Yeah, absolutely. Well, I mean, we have networks in our brain for connection, for being able to connect emotionally, socially, linguistically, for being able to interpret emotions. And so we have these networks, but also, there are books about how important social is. In my own experience, honestly, in working with kids, I can see how being excluded is very painful, or not feeling good enough, not feeling part of the group, is incredibly painful and can end up in some dysfunction over time, especially the more that you feel that way. And so there are a lot of, I could go into books about why this happens and what I see. But I think what's important is that any time that we are not connected to other people, and that we isolate or we are in addictions or traumas that disconnect us, our life doesn't feel good.
So the whole theory of this certainly supports and helps to explain more about attachment theory to some degree, it seems, because of this drive to be attached, connected, and so forth. So what happens if the wiring in our brain isn't working correctly so that we would have some clarity about how to be connected? What happens if that's not functioning well?
Yeah, absolutely. So our nervous system, when it feels safe, connects well, and it feels good, and we feel calm, we feel happy, we feel joy. If our nervous system does not feel safe, if it's more in fight or flight, or if it can't settle itself down, then we struggle to connect, or we can connect in dysfunctional ways, or we get triggered, or these types of things. And so, so what I see, though, when I do my assessments, is that the brain has different ways of protecting itself. Our brain is incredible, it's amazing, and the whole job of the brain is to survive and problem solve. So it uses about 70% of the energy that we put into our bodies. So a lot is used up by our brains, and it controls basically everything we do, in a sense. And so, yeah.
No, go ahead, please.
Oh yeah, yeah. So I was just going to say the different levels that I see, the garden variety PTSD, I see that the area in the brain for emotional comprehension, it idles, and so emotions either get stuffed or get blown up. Another area, the next area that I see a lot of times, is right over the mirror neuron network, and it'll idle the right side of the mirror neuron network, which is where we emotionally connect, and so it disconnects. Not only does it shut down our comprehension area, then the next level is it disconnects us. It says, okay, this is way too overwhelming. I'm just going to disconnect emotionally.
So these mirror neurons that you're talking about, if I could just say, because as you're talking, my mind starts, just going so many places. And you talk about the right side of the brain, which is where the emotional mirror neurons are primarily.
That's right. That's okay. Right. And the left side okay. is linguistic. Yes, that's
okay.
right.
Okay. Mm-hmm.
Yes.
So, mm-hmm. So there are actually strategies around how we're communicating, how we're even looking at each other that impact those mirror neurons that can either make them recoil or want to engage. Is that,
yeah.
is that right?
Okay. Well, it's actually, I see it a little bit differently. I see it that the mirror neurons are the ones that that disconnect us, disengage us. And okay. so if the mirror neurons aren't functioning correctly, or the extended mirror neurons, which is the interpretation of the mirror neurons, if they're not functioning correctly, then our brain is not wired to connect.
Okay. So in other words, the natural tendency of mm-hmm. of the brain's development is to connect and be mirrored.
If there's
something that's happened, either through nurture or maybe even through nature, mm-hmm. Genetically or through our environment experiences, then it can make it essentially damage our mirror neuron capabilities.
That's right. We can see the damage. Not the damage, but genetically we can see that some kids with ADHD, a certain percentage, have a disconnection of the mirror neurons. Of course, those with Asperger's and autism do also. PTSD definitely can disconnect it, depending on how severe it is. So there are other diagnoses that can genetically kids can start out with a mirror neuron disconnect.
So that gets to this other question that we wanted to ask was, how do partners and addicts both struggle with the mirror neuron work? I mean, and I assume that they do both struggle, certainly. So how is it that they both struggle? What's causing that struggle with this needed mirror neuron connection? Do addicts and partners struggle with the mirror neuron
yes.
network? And if so,
yes.
what's causing that struggle?
Yes, absolutely. So yeah, they both struggle with it. And I have partners and addicts come in where I'll just map their brain, and then I'll talk with them about empathy, the limbic overarousal, addiction, and any other things that might interfere with their relationship. And what I find a lot of times is they are disconnected in different areas. Sometimes it's the same area. Sometimes as I go over the brain map, both of them, as I explained, that neither of them really has the capacity for emotional vulnerability at this point in time. I don't want to be emotionally vulnerable. And the other one says that too. And it's like, okay, so you can choose not to, or you can choose that you do want to, and then we can work mm-hmm. towards that goal with the information that we have. Mm-hmm. Sometimes they're disconnected in different ways. The partner with the betrayal trauma, some of the changes that do happen in the brain, they do end up with the idling of the emotional comprehension area. It gets mm-hmm. overwhelming, and so that area shuts down, and it creates a PTSD marker. Mm-hmm. But also there's a part of the brain called the precuneus, where that's where we have the story of who we are. That's who we are. That's who we are in relation to the world. Mm-hmm. Where's our gift? Where is our truth, really? Mm-hmm. And so in betrayal trauma, I've seen with the partners that area can get quite dysregulated because their truth mm-hmm. is not what they mm-hmm. thought it was.
And completely disoriented. And mm-hmm. so it's totally disorganized. What they thought they were, how they felt about themselves, their life, their meaning, their purpose is all disheveled. Like, I think Jake uses the picture of him taking all the files that were organized and throwing them out into the room. And
they're pretty totally much disordered. It.
It's a horrible, yes. horrible place to be.
Yes.
Yeah. See this when you're mapping out the brain.
Yes, yes, yes. Wow. Sex addiction does change the brain in ways that cause disconnection.
So sex addiction mm-hmm. does, yeah, right. So the trauma of the betrayal absolutely impacts the story. Are you
yes.
also saying that the addictive behavior over time impacts that area for the addict also?
Well, yeah. So whenever I see, because I can see a lot of times if that addiction network is still active, I can mm-hmm. see where certain areas are functioning, over-functioning or under-functioning. And it tells me that there likely is still some type of addiction there. Mm-hmm. And so whenever I see this, I have worked with clients before and they don't necessarily have the capacity to connect while their addiction networks are active. So that's what I see a lot of times when I'm working with them. And then when we can disconnect, calm the brain and disconnect, or help them, the client, to have the brain waves they need to be able to actually relax and not be over aroused all the time, then they can connect, better. And so,
So we've already talked about this a little bit, but mm-hmm. maybe I'll go into a little bit more on the question of how exactly does the brain or parts of the brain help us feel more connected or disconnected? I think you've touched on it a little bit, but what aspects of the brain help us to feel connected versus the parts that help us or cause us to feel disconnected?
Yeah, so we have a place called the mm-hmm. sensory motor strip up here, mm-hmm. and the sensory motor strip, it the sensory part of it takes in all of the senses, the your touch and smell and sight and sound, and so it picks up. There's an area underneath it called the insula, and that picks mm-hmm. up subtleties in our environment. As a baby, you learn those subtleties. You learn when your mom looks at you and she's happy, or when your mom looks at you and she's maybe concerned, or things like that. And so, so that's where we pick up subtleties in social emotional communication. Most people have that area. The mirror neurons are working just fine when they're born. If there's a disconnection, and there's attachment issues, then mm-hmm. sometimes that can get disconnected. Sometimes not. Sometimes the attachment issues are not bad enough. Mm-hmm. And sometimes later on, that area can get disconnected if there's sexual abuse, if there's mm-hmm. abuse that's more than just the little T traumas that happen throughout life. These are bigger mm-hmm. T traumas that happen that will completely disconnect it with the overwhelm.
And this connection we're talking about is essentially the connection between what you said was a sensory motor strip and the insula, which picks up mm-hmm. the more subtle aspects of emotional and social communication. Isn't it?
That's right.
So something's mm-hmm. happening in the synapses between those two areas of the brain.
That's right. So what it looks like in terms of if you're in a social situation and that social emotional area is mm-hmm. Disconnected, that you're feeling outside a bit because everybody mm-hmm. is kind of, you know, talking and this and that, mm-hmm. and you get that they're getting things on a different level than you are. And so mm-hmm. sometimes I've seen clients can interpret that as, well, you know, I don't need that emotional mm-hmm. part, that I can do just fine without it. And so because they're not experiencing it. And so there's an mm-hmm. interpretation or a narrative that goes with it. And so that's how it can look like. Sometimes it can look like the opposite too, because I've had clients who are like, I connect great. I connect with everybody. And, you know, and that side of it is that, but it's not an emotional vulnerability that you're connecting. Right. It's not picking up the subtleties, interpreting it, and allowing for emotional vulnerability to come up. Mm. So that is also interpretation is in the temporal lobes. A lot of it's in the emotional interpretation is in the right temporal lobe.
And when we say the temporal lobe, tell us that's sort of in this region. Is that right? Or back here? Okay.
Back
towards
here.
The back. Okay.
Yeah. Towards the back. Yeah.
All right. So.
Well, actually kind of all through here. But that area. Okay. Yeah. Yeah. Mm-hmm.
So just for my sake of clarity for me. Okay. A partner who's been betrayed, or an addict who's been acting out all this time, not really participating in real intimate connection. Mm-hmm. So that's not developed in the addict. And then the partner who's been betrayed is undergoing this trauma. And so their brain is in this place of absolute protection. So those signals there are either going to be hyperactive or underactive.
Well, I see it in a couple of different ways. Over the sensory motor strip, depending on the trauma, I'll see what's called alpha idling. So I know that that spot is idling. Alpha is our idling frequency. And so it's not functioning fully in the way that it needs to function when I see the alpha idling happen. The second level of what I can see sometimes is that beta will form, which is a really fast wave over that sensory motor strip. And the beta creates what it looks like in a client is a need to escape. There's a certain restlessness inside themselves, because again, it's over the sensory motor strip. So there's a certain restlessness that that they just want to escape their body. So I've seen these clients go to marijuana, go to alcohol. I've seen more so that goes with different types of drug addictions. I've seen it more so when that is more environmental trauma.
And which could be, I mean, that this is a conjecture, which could be the basis of some of these secondary addictions that might emerge, right?
That's right.
You know, a lot of times I'll work with clients who are sober sexually, but they'll get into these modes where they sort of get into this trance-like place where we're even reading a book, they can feel like they're just trancing, turning the pages, or certainly looking at a phone or watching something on TV, sort of just go into this trance. Yeah. It's sort of a means of escaping. Is that right? Mm-hmm. Disconnecting. Okay.
Absolutely. Yeah. I have compassion, incredible compassion for both the addict and the partner, you know, the addict brain, a lot of times the biggest, what we call phenotype that I see in the brain is called low voltage fast. And basically this is a brain that goes really fast. It doesn't have anything that is relaxing or calming in it. And so, what they're doing is it's so uncomfortable to, be inside their brains and their bodies that they find things outside of themselves to calm down. When your brain is really fast, you also become external as opposed to internal. So you tend to look outward. You also tend to blame outward. When your brain has that slow in it, then you can reflect inward better. So, you know, when I see that, that's actually a genetic phenotype. So we see it in families. And not everybody, some people with that phenotype, you know, I've seen actually partners come in and they have the same phenotype, the low voltage fast. And I'm like, what I understand about them is that they have just white knuckled it. You know, they were like, they grew up with addiction, let's say, and they said, this is not going to happen to me. And they white knuckled it, but there's still symptoms around it.
I see. So earlier before our interview started, you and I were talking some about the work that you do. Certainly, you do assessment and treatment, neurofeedback, and then, of course, what you refer to as neuromodulation. So the question that comes up for me, how does this work or how does the work that you do help to regulate the brain's ability to connect? How does some of the things you do actually help the client to regulate their ability to connect?
Yeah, my assessment is really, really important. And in the assessment, my whole goal, the client comes in with typically the clients, when they come into me, they've been through therapy, they've tried medication, they know they can maybe thrive more. They just feel stuck in so many senses. Sometimes they feel hopeless. And so I spend a lot of time on the QEEG is what it's called. That's the assessment. My goal in doing that is to be able to come back to the client and say, okay, this is what you brought into me as your struggle and as the questions that you want to have answered. And this is what I'm going to give back to you. Now, many times I can give them the answer and we can start working on treatment. Sometimes it's about further explanation or exploration. So I'll say, you know, what I'm seeing in your brain is that there's likely something medical going on that may be causing some of your symptoms. And so I think we need to follow up with that and figure out what the medical is. I can't give a clear answer, but I can give you a doctor to go to. You know, I can give you what type of doctor you need to go to, which also can be the struggle sometimes. These clients have been to all sorts of doctors. And so, my goal has been, okay, let's get really clear about who you need to go to. Because when you go to four doctors and nobody has an answer for you, it's really, really frustrating. And so I've done a lot of training to get really, really specific with what those needs are. And my goal is is to help in the best way possible to provide healing in a situation mm-hmm. that that has just not seemed to get there.
Mm-hmm. So the assessment's absolute critical component. This mm-hmm. is going to help you see what's going on, share that mm-hmm. with the client, and maybe mm-hmm. help them find further help, or certainly mm-hmm. make a plan forward. We need more assessment. And then, of course, sometimes you're the one that can provide the treatment. And I think you mentioned mm-hmm. neuromodulation is mm-hmm. one of those ways of providing treatment. Tell us a little bit about the treatment that you would provide. Mm-hmm.
Absolutely. So when I do the QEEG, I get really specific about what networks are off in the brain, mm-hmm. as well as I look at brain waves, which are the frequencies in the brain. I look in the different brain waves have different functions. I look at the location and I look mm-hmm. at the waveforms. With all of that information, I'm able to get very, very specific about mm-hmm. where those neuropsychiatric symptoms are coming from and where we need to go to address them. Mm-hmm. And so, again, that's why I spend a lot of time on the assessment, because I want a clear map of where we need to go. Now, the treatment, if we're doing neuromodulation, so I have pulse electromagnetic field therapy, I have photobiomodulation, and I have stimulation therapies, trans alternating current and noise, what's called aperiodic noise or pink noise, okay. brown noise, okay. things like that.
Okay, so let's if it's okay.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm, so sure, I'm gonna, absolutely.
If I were a client, I came to your office, you're going to hook me up to some stuff, mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. okay? And it's going to be like in my head or other parts of my arms or anything like that. Mm-hmm. Or give me a tell about that.
Yeah, it's going to be on your brain. Okay. And I have if we did the treatments with the stimulation, a lot mm-hmm. of times what I do with my trauma clients, the addictive clients, sometimes I do a little bit different. But with my trauma clients, what I find is it really throws off their default mm-hmm. mode network, which is their resting network. Okay. And so I put the electrodes on the places that are going to stabilize that network. I often start out with what's called pink noise. And then a calming frequency. Pink noise is very organizing to the brain. So I'm working on organizing the brain with that. I'll also use pulse electromagnetic field therapy on top of that. That helps provide energy to the brain, and it helps with cellular regeneration. So, a good half hour to 45 minutes after the treatment, I often tell clients, do things that are really healthy for your brain, because your brain is now open to learning.
And this is in terms of physically painless. Is that correct? Physically. In other words, I'm not going to feel a shock to my head or my body or anything like that. Because these are the things clients.
It's a good question. Yeah.
Okay.
I get that question.
Yeah. Okay.
I get that question. Okay. So the photobiomodulation, you feel nothing. The pulsed electromagnetic field therapy, you feel nothing. The stimulation therapies, if I use a stimulation called binaural beats, then you feel nothing. If I use a frequency, then you may feel what clients describe as a little bit of itching. They'll feel some mm-hmm. itching at the electrode site, but if I take the electrode off and I put it on their finger, they don't feel anything. So it's okay. such a small amount of energy that is going there. And so we ramp it up very, very slowly mm-hmm. at the level of what the client can tolerate. And so the idea is that not that you ramp it up like some of the addicts are like, keep it going, bring it up, right. keep it going, you know? and they love the treatment, actually. But it's more about that we're trying to stabilize your brain. And so, but they'll feel it.
So let me, I'm thinking of a couple of questions I've sort of noted here. Mm-hmm. So let's talk about outcomes that you've witnessed, and certainly I can even share some, many anecdotal feedback that I get from clients who have walked through this assessment treatment process that you provide, which is phenomenal. Every client that has talked to me about their experience, they've talked about their clarity improving, and certainly some of these more immediate things where they may need some additional therapy and help and coaching and encouragement, because it is when we're restructuring this thing, it can be maybe overwhelming and scary, right?
When you're restructuring the brain,
Because you know some of the clients are like, you know, I didn't know how to feel at first, and then, you know, Laura told me this, my therapist told me that, and so just doing it and walking away without further help and coaching and encouragement is not a good idea.
Yeah,
right?
absolutely not with trauma. Yeah, that's right, not with trauma and addiction clients, definitely not. And so so a lot of times what I'm doing is working on the nervous system, and I'm trying to bring their nervous system to a space where it feels safe, as opposed to in fight or flight. And so when the brain feels safe, then emotions can come up that have been stored in the amygdala, which is where we store our emotional overwhelming memories. And so when these start to come up, then clients need they need support for allowing those to come up. That would be therapeutic support. Wow. And in terms of the brain networks performing better, so we can get those areas better regulated. But if a person has never picked up on the subtleties, the social emotional subtleties, or is struggles with emotional comprehension, and that's been true for their whole life or most of their life, then they never develop the skills. And so they need a coach or a therapist to help them with the skills of with behavioral and thinking and just social emotional understanding.
Right. Even words to describe what it is that I'm feeling here. I'm feeling something. Whereas before, the disconnect, as we pointed out earlier, was so severe, they didn't know what to feel. They didn't have a particular feeling. Like you said, they were sort of felt like they were on the outside looking in. And now they're not. Now this is being healed, and they're like, okay, how do I interpret this now? And that's what they need therapy help and coaching around.
Especially when you're working with couples, because they have these automatic triggers that are going off in them. So they need a different way to experience that that potential emotional vulnerability.
Go ahead.
Oh, I was going to say that part, the emotional vulnerability, is very scary to, it's scary to a partner, because it's like, you know, many of them are like, well, I did that, and then this happened, and then my whole, you know, everything in me is kind of shut it down. And that is that fight or flight drive that's kicked in. And they're afraid to stop protecting themselves. And so we have to work through that.
Right. Well, and work through, I think once those connections are made, one can see how we're not talking about being vulnerable to the point you have no boundaries, right? I mean,
we're going to
learn to be vulnerable.
Yes.
So sort of a whole brain, a whole healthy brain approach.
Oh, absolutely.
Yeah, I'm going to be vulnerable. I'm going to learn to be vulnerable, while at the same time, I'm going to have very clear boundaries that are measurable, and I can see what's going on. Absolutely.
That's right. With authentic living, if you want to live in an authentic way, you have to have some emotional vulnerability. You have to have the ability to understand what's inside of yourself, and to be able to share it with your partner in a way that's hopefully unprotected. But we don't want to start that way. We have to start with keeping that protection until we know that we can maybe step back on the protection. The treatments, actually, like, I can think of a client in particular who had the basic mirror neuron struggle, and so struggled with those social emotional cues. And so we worked on those areas. We worked on the insula. And his wife gave him feedback that, you know, when he was at, like, they went to parties and things like that, he didn't like the social aspect of it. And he was more, you know, so she says to him, well, you were talking to everybody. And he didn't even recognize it, honestly. It just was easier for him to do that because that area within the brain was functioning better. Sometimes it happens like that. That was not one of my trauma and addiction clients. That was actually another client. With the trauma and addiction clients, I find that because there's so much, there can be so much toxicity between them and in their lives, that we really need to work on the therapeutic and coaching aspects to help them unwind some of what they've learned.
As you said, you know, if we're helping, if an addict suddenly does this treatment and they have, you know, understanding a better connection, social nuances and everything, they're not in a place, if they're healing their relationship, to suddenly become a social butterfly and be talking to everybody in the room, right? Because they need learn to focus that connection on their partner who is going through this trauma. So absolutely, coaching there.
There are other parts to it. I have clients who come in. I have clients who'll come in and I'm just calming their nervous system down. And whereas they used to need to either control, or they had, you know, struggles with letting go of things, I'll have clients come back to me and say, yeah, I just let it go. I didn't need to let them know that this is what needed to happen, or let her know, you know?
Right.
And so it feels so much better to be able to just let it go and not have to be in control of everything or hold all the balls up in the air. So that's one thing that I've seen. Another thing that I've seen in some of my addictive clients is I'll work on that sensory motor strip sometimes where they are, they have that need to escape. And then all of a sudden they're like, okay, I'm not really having the cravings for say smoking pot anymore, or for alcohol. I'm not having those cravings anymore because that restlessness has settled down, it's calmed down. But sometimes, you know, they're like, okay, but I don't know what to do now because it's such
right. How do I engage? What do I engage in? Right.
That's all. But also their friends, you know, there's a lot that they have to change in their life in order to accommodate the change of the healing of the brain. And the two places where I find that that clients struggle with their brain's healing in the work that I do, one, if their environments are still toxic in terms of communication, or there's a lot of dysfunction, because the brain will protect itself and function as it can in the environments that it's in. So if it goes from my office feeling safe to another space where it does not feel safe, then it'll move back into the fight or flight networks to protect itself. And so the other area where clients struggle is if there's an underlying medical issue. The brain and body are so interconnected with trauma and addiction. There's so much off on the body that in terms of the body being in constant fight or flight, that sometimes we have to address maybe the energy that the brain is receiving from the body because of all the flood of the fight or flight hormones for years and years often.
Yeah. And, I was just reading an article actually earlier today about how critical hydration is to the function of the brain, how critical conscious breathing is to the function of the brain, and just basic physical activity, going for a walk. So those are three things that I often tell clients that can have a calming effect. Make sure you're hydrated. And they're like, oh, what's that got to do with that? Oh my Lord, the research on just a little bit of dehydration, not enough fluid in your body, impacts the functioning of the brain. And this is just amazingly true. Being able to walk and consciously breathe impacts the function. How big of an impact are those kinds of things?
Oh, absolutely. Clients, I always talk to them about how they can quicken the process of what I do by implementing some of these healthy, things into their lives. But yes, what we eat makes a difference. If we're carving it and our blood sugar is off a lot, then that's going to affect our brain. So what we eat is huge. Staying hydrated is very important. Exercising is important. The sleep, oh my gosh, so many of my clients struggle with different aspects of sleep. And so many of them, they'll come in sometimes in the morning, they're on, of course, a stimulant. And then at night, they're on something to put them to sleep. And I always have a sense that when I look at their EEG, I'm going to see sleep in their EEG, which is not really what I want to see when it's supposed to be a waking EEG. And then I know that potentially they have a sleep disorder. And lowering stress, living more simply, connecting spiritually. When you connect spiritually, when you pray, you actually can bring your brain down into theta waves, which is a slower brain wave, and it's relaxing. So you can do it on your own. There are things that you can do on your own in order to support balanced and better functioning in your brain.
So with all the work that you've done, what's the theory or the hypothesis that, that you may have developed around the work that you've done and how you see it making a difference? A lot of this probably you've already touched on, but I'm kind of wondering about that basic hypothesis that you have, Laura, as you approach your work here, particularly in this field of betrayal trauma and addiction.
Yeah, yeah. So I actually have some working hypotheses that I'm working with, and I haven't yet, confirmed whether those are correct or not. But basically, one is that if we can use the brain-based work in order to help regulate the nervous system better, along with the coaching and the therapy and the other services that clients receive at Daring Ventures, then instead of say the 3 to 5 years that it takes to stabilize, or if there's complex trauma or a personality struggle, then it can be 5 to 10 years. It can take a lot longer. And so my working hypothesis is that if we incorporate brain-based work into this work that's already being done, that we can lower the amount of time that it takes to heal. And we can also help them to heal in a way that's not quite as painful, but has less, because the brain is more regulated. When the brain is more regulated, it can process things better.
Mm-hmm. Wow, that alone is a huge thing, because one of the most basic questions when I'm working with particularly the addict coming right out of disclosure, and there's a lot of pain and he, generally it's he, not always, but the betraying partner, the one who did the betraying, will often ask, oh my God, I've done so much damage to my partner. How long is it possible, and how long, right? And of course, my answer is typically, yes, obviously it is possible. There's a lot of work to be done, but it's absolutely possible, because we see it. We get to witness that in many, many couples that come through our practice. But in terms of the time, I sort of stick with, Carnes is 3 to 5 years at least, right? Longer if there are a lot of underlying disorders that may be going on, as you just suggested. The idea that this kind of work could abbreviate that is absolutely huge. And that's that would be great news. Yeah. And so far, as an observation, I think I'm witnessing that with some of the people who come through your assessment and treatment process.
Oh, I would love to hear what you're seeing, Wendell. I would love to hear that.
Yeah, just the clarity of an awareness of what's going on for the addict primarily. Just the awareness of, oh, I know what's going on now. I have greater clarity of how to breathe, of how to relax, and it seems, as you said, to settle down that central nervous system, so that, because one of the major issues in relational healing is when the betrayed partner has a need, the addict overreacts to that, or the betrayed partner is activated or triggered, as many people call it, the addict will react, like, oh my, they will be triggered as a result of their triggered, as a result of the partner being triggered. So being able to just be more settled and not as reactive helps the healing process.
Oh, totally. On both sides, it does. Totally. Because when your nervous system is activated, then the time to communicate with your spouse, especially with anything that's important, is when your nervous system is in a spot where it feels safe. And because then you can communicate in a way that is not hurtful to either of you. But if you're communicating both in a state of fight or flight, then it's not going to work. It's not going to work.
It keeps escalating, doesn't it?
It keeps getting worse and worse, and escalating. So the idea with that, in terms of my work, is to get the brain to a place where, again, the brain and the body feel safer. And then we can communicate in a place where the nervous system is calmer and not as reactive. The other thing I see that helps addicts that I thought about when you were talking is some of the addicts is that many of them I find have learning disabilities, and they didn't necessarily know that as a child. Some of them did, some of them didn't. Some of them just thought they were different. And so what I find is if you if you grow up in a household mm-hmm. that can't validate who you are and mm-hmm. that you feel less than in the household, and then you go to mm-hmm. school, and again, you feel less than because you have learning disabilities, but it's never identified mm-hmm. or it's not identified correctly, mm-hmm. Then again, you feel less than again. You feel less than everywhere. So why not escape into mm-hmm. drugs or mm-hmm. sex or right. alcohol right. or whatever your choice is, right? Mm-hmm. And so they learn that, yeah, you know, I think you had dyslexia as a child. Does that fit for you? Because I'm seeing that those areas of your brain are not, you know, and they're like, oh, I knew that, but yeah, now that you say it and it opens this whole world up of, oh, wow, that it's, you know, that because I think they place so much shame upon themselves about all of it. And some of it is just that needs were not addressed. Mm-hmm. When they were in school or of course at home. Yeah. And if those needs had been addressed better, then it's likely that they would function better.
Right. Well, it's fascinating. I was looking at some material earlier about brain development, actually about a month ago, and where the great debate about nature and nurture, is it one or the other? And the reality is not many people are debating that anymore because we kind of know that it's both, right?
Oh, absolutely. Both.
And that nurturing piece can make up for a lot of deficiencies that a person might have. And is that what we've learned?
Oh, absolutely. I've got a really good case that demonstrated this. I was just amazed at this case. So this particular mm-hmm. case actually was medical trauma, that this particular mm-hmm. person as a child through adolescence had, or through college years, had to have like 18 surgeries because of a genetic struggle that they had. So there was a lot mm-hmm. of medical trauma. Family is nurturing and loving and emotionally connected. Mm-hmm. And so I was really expecting to see the PTSD marker. I was really expecting to see signs of trauma in this particular person's brain. I did not see the PTSD marker. And I believe that that is because he didn't have to idle his emotional spot, you know, in the brain, because his parents kept that emotional connection open for him. He felt rejected a lot because he, in his development growing up, do the things that other boys are able to do. And so that area was a little bit more off,
but that home-based sense of security and sense of safety that he had was critical to being able to help him, even though he had a medically based, issues with his brain.
Absolutely. Wow.
And you know, Absolutely. That nurturing piece is really, and this is hard, if I could mm-hmm. just say this is the most challenging component of relational healing that I work with addicts and with partners, with couples, is the fact that the addict has to, or the request is, the hope is that the addict can move from this person who did these horrible things that caused significant injury, to move from that person to a person who is now trustworthy as a nurturer. That's really the goal, isn't it? Is to move them from this person who did the injury to mm-hmm. a person who can be healthy enough to say, I'm okay, let me be the nurturer now. That's kind of what we're aiming for, isn't it? That's huge. That requires like a miracle, but there is a process, isn't there?
Yeah. As a matter of fact, I have, I can think of client addicts that I've worked with that, you know, will all say right to them, your wife is, she's longing to connect with you on an emotional mm-hmm. level. She wants, you know, that's when she says, you know, that you need to heal more deeply. That's what she's saying, is I want to connect with you on an emotional level. Right. And they'll say back, I want to do that too. Mm-hmm. I want to connect with her at certain levels of where they're at, right? Sure, I want to connect with her, but I don't know how to, and I can't. And so that's a great place to start.
Yeah. Laura, one final question. Thank you. This has been so enlightening to me. And as you maybe as others hear this, you could be, what I'm doing, I'm thinking, you know, what's my brain doing right now? How's this thing functioning? You know, or am I making a connection between the different parts? But I guess a final question would be, what are some visions that you have around the future direction of the work that you're doing? How do you see it, and how do you see the work that you're doing in the future? Not perhaps just in terms of how it relates to betrayal, trauma, and addiction, but in other fields?
Oh, there's just so much mm-hmm. right now. It's just an exploding area. In the work that we're doing at Daring Ventures, the mm-hmm. next thing that I'm really working on is bringing in children and adolescents, because when there has been a betrayal due to sex addiction, the couple gets locked in their toxic exchange for a while with their struggles. Mm-hmm. And so the children are not necessarily getting their needs met because the adults are embroiled and overwhelmed mm-hmm. with what's going on with them. Mm-hmm. And so children, their brains mm-hmm. have to develop protective parts. They develop parts that want to escape. Some of them have learning disabilities that don't necessarily get completely addressed because of the chaos that's going on in the household. And so bringing children and adolescents and working with the family as a whole is a next thing that I want to do, stabilizing the whole family unit so that the children and the adolescents, as they grow up, can become functional adults also. Yeah.
So, Laura, thank you. This is amazing work. I'm really, really grateful to have the opportunity to interview you today. I want to ask you, if anybody's hearing this and they want to get directly in touch with you and ask questions or talk about would they be a candidate for this kind of assessment and treatment, how would they get in touch with you? Best way?
Yeah, the absolute best way to get in touch with me is with my email, because okay. I'm in session so often during the day. And my mm-hmm. email is Laura, L-A-U-R-A, at daringventures.com, which is okay. daringventures.com.
And I think on our website, there is a web page about mm-hmm. the work that you do, so people can visit that and find out more about that. Laura, right. Thank you so much. Thank you. This has just been really wonderful. I want to encourage clients to consider this as a possible avenue for their continued growth, reaching beyond perhaps where they are right now. And the future can be bright. It's about learning about ourselves and making those adjustments and getting help, getting connected with the community that's there to help us. So thank you a whole bunch. Laura, any final words?
No, I think
okay.
I'm good.
Okay.
I think I have. So thank you.
Thank you.
All
right. You've been listening to Betrayal Recovery Radio, the official podcast of APSAT. If you've received help or hope from this episode, I encourage you to share it with someone you know. If you've not yet done so, please subscribe to our podcast on your favorite listening platform. Thank you for joining us. I'm Dr. Jake Porter, and you can always email me directly at jake@apsats.org. I'd love to hear your ideas, questions, or comments about the show. Until next time, keep choosing to use your voice and live your values. It's good for you and for this world.